A new study has revealed Australia's highly complex insurance landscape is a major factor in the underinsurance of homes in flood zones, rather than owners' complacency. Researchers of the study investigated over 600 households across Melbourne's flood-prone areas to understand how people make decisions over flood insurance. The Wire's Tony Pankaluik spoke to Associate Professor in Geography at the University of Melbourne, Dr. Brian Cook, to learn more.
It's really important that we realize it's not just the environment, it's not just people, it's not just economics, it's not just land use, it's all of those things all at once in interacting with one another in, I guess, an increasingly unpredictable way because of climate change. And so we have more variable precipitation. So you might have more rain coming in a shorter period of time, which would overflow banks or do things that it hasn't done in the past. Or you might have someone who's applied to build a house closer to the river or got permission to build in a location that may be flooded once every 100 years. And so now we have an asset in a location that's more subject to flooding while the climate is changing and the precipitation and river patterns are changing. So you've got that sort of interaction between land use and climate. And then I think an important part to add to that is, you know, we've all got smartphones or more technologies. And as Australians become more wealthy, we're putting more assets at risk. So inside that home that's now built in a place where we used to not build, we've got more valuable things to lose so that when a flood does come, the costs are higher. And so I think when we think about flooding in Australia, we've got multiple factors all coming together to raise the risk that we're facing collectively.
Can you go into detail about the challenges people are facing when dealing with insurance companies? Because I know this is a very big topic that came up in the research.
Yeah, so recently published that paper. And so what we were very curious about is how people were experiencing that system. So I should be accurate and say, I haven't looked at what the insurance companies are doing or saying. I'm talking to people and their accounts of it. I can report on that. And the thing that I would say is that people are not unaware. They're not ignorant. They're not indifferent. They're actually very concerned about flooding because they see the news and, you know, the 2022 events and all sorts of recent floods. And so people are trying to address this very, very complicated and uncertain kind of social economic context. And then we add on to that the insurance sector and the profit motivation that's there, as well as the extreme risk that public finances are facing with the threat of these floods. And so people, when they describe the process, they would say to us, oh, you know, this insurance company gives me this kind of quote and another one gives a completely different one. So like, what's going on with that? Or they might be rezoned due to updated modeling or understanding and they'll go, I used to have insurance that covered me for $1,000 and it's now $5,000. And so there's a real, especially in the cost of living kind of crisis that a lot of households are going through, that's a really significant consideration that they have to bring to that. In other circumstances, it's unclear whether flooding is covered by the insurance. And so they might say, well, riverine is covered, but flash flooding isn't, or groundwater flooding isn't, or like there's some definitions and different insurance policies have different terms for these things. Sometimes cover it, they sometimes don't. And the one thing I'd also add is most people don't know what their house is exactly worth or what it would cost to replace their house. They might have bought the house 10 years ago and it's doubled or tripled in value. They have no idea what it would cost to build a house. And so when they go in and talk to an insurer and they go, like, how much should this be insured for? It's hard to say. We know that with inflation and things of that nature, the cost of building a house, you know, if you have to haggle with an insurer for a year about getting a payout on a home that was affected, it could be that 5% has gone up. And so people look at that entire situation, the uncertainty of it, the unpredictability of it, the kind of lack of transparency, the inconsistency. And I think they very rationally, I don't want to say that they're broken by it, but it creates a real blockage that isn't a product of a lack of information. It's a lack of clarity about what can be done, what should be done, where the trade-offs have to come from, and I think a lack of confidence and trust that even if they did everything right, that it would come out well, right? Like, so I think you hear people go, if I spent all this money on a flood and then a flood came through and then the insurer is going to try and haggle me down or not cover it. And so there's a lack of trust and an uncertainty that come together. And I think if I'm being honest about myself, when you face those kinds of situations, it's sometimes easier to just throw your hands up in the air and walk away, or to put your head in the sand, or say, I'll get to this next weekend. And I think that's a reasonable response given how hard it is to come to a decision. And that's the situation that we find ourselves in with a lot of households there. So it's not that they don't want it. It's not that they wouldn't do it if there wasn't clarity. It's not that they're unwilling to invest. It's that it's so hard to come to the right answer.
So that basically explains why there's a big misconception of underinsurance because of all those varying factors that you outlined. And that's why people just, you know, they're strained by budgets and just various reasons, and it makes exactly. life difficult.
Well, and I think in any decision, right, if you are a household and you've got a budget and you go, the kids need braces or we're going to do flood insurance, and you start to open up the internet and you're trying to do one of those comparisons and you're not sure that it's going to actually be covered, and you know, you see the news about someone who's been refused payout for something, and in the meantime, you're kind of looking at your kid's teeth and you're like, that's for sure. So I think the thing that really struck us from the research was this wasn't people trying to avoid paying money, or this wasn't people who were in denial about the risk. They get that. People see that. And I think they'd love to get through it because it is a stress on people. People want to know that they're protected. They really don't want to have this worry in the back of their mind. I mean, life's full of those. And if you can eliminate them, people want to eliminate them. They're willing to do the investment for the most part. It's that there is this lack of surety that they could do what's necessary, or a lack of confidence in the outcome.
Now, Brian, this was something that's very interesting that came up in the article. Does having an improved flood mapping and modeling done by governments help with the situation?
Yeah, I should note, you know, I work with Melbourne Water here, and they've funded some of the research. Mm-hmm. And I should declare my interest. And so what we're seeing, and this is actually something that is happening all over the world in most of the developed world, is modeling is getting better. And so we're improving our techniques for predicting this, and we're coming up with modeling. And sometimes, you know, if we're being honest, governments have in the past wanted to delay investing because it's expensive to do the modeling. And so we're updating modeling, and then we're finding out that some of the locations where we've permitted building in the past are subject to flooding or are likely to be affected by a 1% flood. You know, most people would understand as a flood that happens one in 100 years, but it's probably better to think of it as a flood that has a 1% chance of happening in any year. And so updating the modeling, I would say, is not only helpful, but is essential, because you need to have some understanding of your probability of being affected in order to inform that decision about whether or not to spend on insurance or on some adaptation or mitigation action, which will obviously bear some costs at the household level. And so my opinion would be that modeling is needed, and it's a really important aspect of the decision. I guess my view on it is it's just one part of that very complicated decision that people are facing. And so I don't know that we can say, hey, the modeling's been done, we're out, or, you know, like we've done everything we can. That's not the case, right? Like, the modeling is a key part of it, and we need these experts and these people to provide that information. Then it becomes a discussion about, like, well, what do you do with the modeling? Who has access to the modeling? What does it look like when it's presented to people? And I would say one of the key parts of the research was that in most cases, we have local councils who are receiving this updated modeling, and they know it's bad news. If you own a home, it's probably your most valuable asset. It's probably the thing that you have in the back of your mind as, like, your retirement, you know, like it's your castle. It's the thing you want to pass on to your kids. It is probably your most important asset. And so you go out to the mailbox one day and you open up a letter from council and it says, you're now at flood risk. Like, I think it's important that we just all imagine ourselves in that position. We should recognize how awful that is. That is a threat to someone's long-standing livelihood. And to know then that comes with cost. So all of a sudden your insurance premiums might go up. All of a sudden you might be made responsible for taking some actions. And you've not done anything wrong, right? Like, you just bought a house. You may have even checked whether or not there was flood risk previously, And the earlier model said it was fine or it didn't say. And so the modeling is key to that update. And it's better to know than to not know, that's for sure. But I think what our participants told us is, help us out here. Don't just don't leave me to walk out and open my mailbox and have like the worst news of the month or the year. Come and talk to us about it. Help me understand what the nature of this problem is or what's changed. Help me get a grip on where that flood level might be. Help me understand what I can do at the household level to mitigate that. And I should say, a lot of councils are trying to do that. They're under real financial pressure. We all know that. But for example, we collaborated with Mornington Council, and they did just such a lovely job of reaching out to people after the modeling is done and they had surveyed homes. And they tried to go out to the community, and often the community didn't want to engage with it. And so it's a really fraught situation. In that case, we had a council sending out letters and trying to engage with people and getting a very poor response. And then the research team that I lead, we went and door knocked at a lot of these households. And we said, you know, would you be willing to engage with us on this? And a lot of people were fearful. They'd say, no, I don't want the insurance company to know that the risk has changed because they're going to raise all my premiums. You know, so there's this sort of conflict there, and it's very tense. And there's a lot of people who maybe don't trust the modeling or don't trust the council or think that it's all just a money grab, or they want more clarity on the parameters of the modeling so that they can assess things. And I think these are all reasonable things for someone who's being affected by flooding to ask for. And so the modeling is really, really useful, but it's one step on a long journey.
If there's anything else you'd like to add, yeah, feel free, Brian, as we just wrap up.
Yeah, I guess the thing that I would add was just the part is that I think sometimes gets forgotten is that we are the community. Mm-hmm. It's often like government and people. And it's like, no, you know, the people we work with in council, they're doing the best they can. The people we talk to at their homes, they're under stress, but they're also doing the best that they can. And most people are really genuine in trying to want to find a solution to move this forward and to improve things. And I think deep down, the vast majority of people know that the current situation is pretty unsustainable. And so we all know we're going to be on the hook for major, major expenses when these big events come. And we'd be better off addressing it and trying to make a lot of little actions that collectively help us avoid the major, major costs that are involved in these sorts of disasters. And I think people do want to partner on that, and they are willing to engage on it. But that's maybe a positive way of, you know, kind of updating where people are. It's not always antagonistic. People are more than happy to have honest and productive discussions. And I get the sense that if we make the steps that are needed clear, and we're transparent about it, and we help people along, and we don't just like leave the burden on every individual to navigate on their own, that we work on it as a collective and as a community, I get the sense we can get a lot of traction in that way. That would be my, I guess, very hopeful way of summarizing the work.
That was Dr. Brian Cook from the University of Melbourne speaking with The Wire's Tony Pankalowicz.